This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the actor Anne-Marie Duff. Most people in her profession spend a lot of time out of work. She is very clearly not most people. Her roll call of parts is abundant and anguish-laden, whether it's playing Lady Macbeth on Broadway, Elizabeth I on the BBC, or Joan of Arc at the National Theatre. Her work rate and the characters she inhabits are formidable. The seeds of her ambition took root in what appears at first glance to be unlikely soil, a grey breeze-block council estate in suburban West London, where her Irish parents had settled to try to make a living and a life. Then again, maybe it was her upbringing, which she describes as rich in fun and love, that gave her the confidence to pursue the precarious ambition of pretending to be other people. She says, "I came from a very working-class background, and the idea that you could make more of yourself through culture, that it could give you wings, was just phenomenal to me." I love that expression, that it could give you wings. And do you feel changed when you've been through, especially a part that does require us, so many of your parts seem to, plumbing those emotional depths?
Yeah, I guess you do. You come out feeling like you'd had a sort of Turkish massage.
Do you?
Yeah.
Are you a superstitious person? Do you have rituals before you go on stage?
I am fantastically superstitious. I know it's not fashionable to say it, but I am. I'm a really old school superstitious actor. And I, for example, won't say Macbeth unless I'm in it. I can say it because I'm in it right now.
Right.
And I have little rituals that I do before shows. Different ones on different shows, and one specific one I do on every play.
Will you tell me what it is?
Yeah, I always have to have a shower at a half-hour call.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have a shower at a half-hour call, wash the day off.
I read that you use different perfumes when you play. Different perfumes for different parts.
Different characters, yeah.
Joan of Arc, of course, it was one of your towering performances. What was her perfume?
She didn't have one, because we wanted the notion of her being a pilgrim at the very beginning of the play, so I'd have to have, my feet were filthy, like I'd done this huge walk in peace or something. So I used to have a box of soil, you know, backstage that I would definitely rub on my feet, as well as the makeup, and the smell of that always was very strong.
Goodness. Anne-Marie Duff, we're going to go to your music. I want you to tell me about this first disc. Why have you chosen it?
I was desperately trying to think of something that would connect me to my childhood. And I have Irish parents, and I thought at first, oh, it'll be something Irish. And then I thought, no, actually, what was my life? My life as a child was the 70s London. There's a real sort of like rainbow of different minorities, people from everywhere else. And that was a very specific feeling in the 70s because you weren't always welcome. It was weird as a kid. You know, I had experiences that probably similar to maybe Muslim kids now put on the radio and hear on talk shows. But people would say, well, Irish people were terrorists or what have you, you know. My parents, Mary and Brendan, were fantastic dancers, and they listened to a lot of reggae. Reggae was massive in the 70s. And this particular song is just so, makes me think of sunshine, and it makes me think of the two of them dancing and them having parties. And as soon as you hear the intro to this song, you just go, oh, joy.
Rasta Ozzy from up the hill decide to check on him grocery bill. And when him add up the things him need, the duny done with him safe fi buy little weed. Him hand pan him jaw, Lord, read him eye and just meditate. The time is so hard, Lord, I man nothing about immigrate. I make up my mind, Lord, I might as well go against Simon.
That was Pluto Shervington and that, and you said so beautifully there, Anne-Marie Duff, you evoked this time when, you know, very particular atmosphere, being brought up in a suburb of West London in the 70s and your parents dancing. They were very good dancers.
Yeah.
I've read you say before that they had come to the UK because, this is your phrase, they weren't able to fulfil their dreams. What would they have done if they hadn't been sort of compromised by economics?
Well, I think it was more difficult for them to articulate their dreams. I know that my mother was a very talented athlete, but that wasn't able to be encouraged for various reasons. You know, I'm not making any judgments on anybody. And my dad was super bright, you know, and very well read. He's still a huge reader, you know. And
was it a house with lots of books in it?
Well, we didn't own a lot of books because it didn't occur to me that you could own books. But we went to the library all the time.
Sure.
And we were always borrowing books. And I still am a real bookworm.
And what was your dad's job?
He was a painter and decorator. He worked for Fuller's Brewery in Chiswick.
And would they have taken you to the theatre?
No, that wasn't really part of... Well, first of all, it's fantastically expensive to go and see the theatre in London. It is elsewhere too, but in London, certainly. It wasn't something that would even occur to you as a working-class parent, I suspect. You'd have other priorities.
Tell me about this second piece of music. Why have you chosen it?
Well, first of all, when I was at school, I joined the school choir. And I had a fantastic music teacher called Mr. Vinyl, Des Vinyl. I know, Vinyl, brilliant name for a music teacher. Mm. And he had this beautiful choir, and I discovered I could sing. I could really sing. And so I found myself a singing teacher in the Yellow Pages, and I used my money from my Saturday job to pay for my singing lessons. And her name was Phyllis Roast. I'd never met anyone like her in my life. She was this tiny wee old lady, and she taught the Royal College of Music, and...
And you just found her in the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, it was like serendipitous, you know. And she lived in this flat in Ealing that was, you know, there were rugs. And you'd walk in and I'd think, what is that smell? It's perfume and something else. And now, of course, I'm grown up, I realise it was garlic. And I'd never smelled garlic before.
No, but exotic.
It was so exotic. And she was everything that I imagined the world of the theatre or what it would be like. It was in this tiny wee old woman who had this shawl and would properly teach me to sing. It wasn't just show tunes. It was a classical training. This song is one of the arias that I worked on with her, and she was phenomenal for me. I found it very difficult to get into drama school, and so I didn't get in the first time round. I reached a crossroads where I could, well, maybe I'll be a singer. Maybe that's what I'll do. And we talked about it in great depth, and she just looked at me and she said, but I think you have the soul of an actor. And she was so extraordinary for me, you know, and I'll just never forget her little blue eyes and how hard I worked with her also cracked my mind open to a whole world of music that I'd never heard before.
Chi il bel sogno di Doretta from La Rondine by Puccini, sung there by Montserrat Caballé with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Mackerras. Anne-Marie Duff, your head was bowed throughout it. Where were you?
You know that brilliant lyric, Joni Mitchell lyric, songs are like tattoos?
Yes.
And they are, aren't they? I suppose I was thinking about beginnings because it was a representative point of my life where I was absolutely at base camp and everything lay ahead of me and I was swollen with hope and potential and all those amazing things that you see in young people. And I was excited because I guess I knew on a deep level that I would be part of that world.
This idea of, I quoted you in the beginning there, of course, of it giving you wings, that's a very powerful image there. Mm. This idea that actually it was through artistic expression, through performance, that you could soar out of, you know, from whence you came.
Yeah.
Was there a sense in which you wanted to get out of that sort of breeze block, tower block existence? Your
mum
and...
Of course, I would defy anyone who doesn't grow up in those environments to say that they wouldn't rather be somewhere else. But, you know, you still have it, still who you are, and it's important to keep a hold of it. Just the width of a wingspan, that's what it's all about too, isn't it?
To not get into drama school the first time then must have been, at the time, for you...
Crushing. Because I had no other plan, and also I didn't know how else to do it. I had no one in my life involved in that world. And for me, it was absolutely about becoming a classical actor, you know, and I had quite a romantic head about it all, really. I wanted to be in the royal court in the 60s. That's what I wanted. And my dad was brilliant. I remember him one day putting his arm around me and he used to call me Smudge. And he said, come on, Smudge. You just have to be patient and keep believing and try.
What did you do in that year then? When you
I went off and studied film for a year. Did a bit more higher education.
You've said that you were considered at drama school once you did get in as the runt of the year.
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I wasn't never, ever going to be a leading lady. I would only ever play small parts in
Were you told this?
Pretty much. And I went to a drama school where you were given sort of term's notice if you were going to be asked to leave at the end of term, quite famously, Drama Centre. And so I was always on a term's warning, always. But the great thing about that was that I wrote 1,000 letters in my final year and walked straight into work straight after.
Anne-Marie Duff, tell me about your next piece. What are we going to hear now?
Well, I figure if I'm on a desert island, I want something that has nothing to do with anything other than jumping up and down and getting my knickers in a twist. There is also nothing sexier than a man with a guitar. That's just so true. You give any man a guitar and his sex appeal, bong, just flies through the roof. So I picked a White Stripes track because they're an amazing band and this was an amazing album. And this is so saucy and naughty and all about sex, and I'm all for that. So I picked White Stripes, Ball and Biscuit.
It's quite possible that I'm your third man, girl, but it's a fact that I'm the seventh son. I'm the seventh son.
White Stripes, Ball and Biscuit, all about the sex, as you said, Anne-Marie Duff. Something to get your knickers in a twist to on the island. We've mentioned already playing Joan of Arc. There's no way of avoiding it. It is a career-defining role.
Well, that was a dream come true. I literally had dreamt of playing that role in my teens. And then I got a phone call one day. I had a tiny flat in Finsbury Park. And I remember just sitting on the sofa going, yeah. And I literally couldn't speak for about 20 minutes after I hung up. I was like, oh, my God.
That was 2007, and I was looking back at some of the reviews. They were uniformly superb. And did you at any time feel weighed down by, you know, Sybil Thorndike or Joan Plowrice or Frances de la Tour, who'd all done it to great acclaim in the generations that had gone before you?
Any play that's not new, there's always ghosts.
How do you get rid of the ghosts?
Sometimes it's really hard. But I think Marianne had a lot to do with that. The director had a lot to do with that, making us feel like it was our own fresh new production.
So that huge auditorium with all the bums on the seats and all the people that have paid, just take me, if you can take yourself back, to just standing in the wings on the first night.
I felt like I was playing Glastonbury. That's the only way to explain it. I'd never worked in the Olivier before. I'd never worked in that size auditorium. I literally felt, I stood there backstage, I remember it so clearly, with the soil on my feet, felt like a rock star. It's the only way to describe it. And I've never had that feeling since. I'd never had my face on a poster like that before. I wasn't the person that had sold tickets before. It was a really lovely feeling of devil may care, of going, you know what, give me my guitar. I am out there tonight and I'm going to blow your minds. So it was really fun.
Tell me about your fourth. What are we going to hear now?
I have picked a Bjork track. As a woman, I feel like I've sort of grown up with her. You know, I listened to Sugar Cubes when I was a teenager, and then her first album came out just as I left drama school. I listened to it all the time. I wore the tape out because it's tape cassette, cause that's how old I am. And this particular track really takes me back to a time in my 20s where I went, you know what, Anne-Marie, you've done a lot of thinking about theatre. You've done a lot of being a very good girl. Now why don't you just go out and have some fun? And it's very specifically of a time when I really let my hair down, did lots of things I shouldn't have done, a good girl should not have done, but I had a really, really great time. It was the mid-90s. It was a fantastically cool time to be here. London was a great place to be. And if we went out after shows, you would find yourself mixing with Brit artists, as they were called, or writers, playwrights, you know. Yeah, and it's just sort of about that feeling, a feeling... kind of sort of the invincibility of youth, I guess.
Your flesh finds cracking me. Smith danced me with her.
That was Björk and Possibly Maybe. Anne-Marie Duff, you said going into that, I did a lot of things a good girl should not have done.
Mm.
You're not going to tell me what they were, are you?
No.
No, how frustrating for
me. My mum and dad might be listening.
You have, as I speak to you, a sort of lightness of spirit, which I wasn't necessarily expecting, having watched so many of the things. You play these anguished parts so often. And I'm thinking now of the suicidal Nora in Ibsen's A Doll's House. You played that in 2001 on stage, and by all accounts, from what I've read, the lines became sort of blurred. There was a point at which did you walk off stage
one
night?
Yeah, I had proper stage fright. I had this experience where I became very aware that I was unhealthily pushing myself into the character's noggin. Like, you know those trombone shots in movies? It was like this moment where the whole stage, my perspective completely shifted, and I actually had the sentence in my head, I don't want to be a crazy person and I'm definitely not going to be a crazy actress. So I walked off stage, and Patterson Joseph, I thank him for my whole career, really, because that's a long time ago. And he looked at me and he said exactly the right thing. He put his hands on my shoulder and he said, Anne-Marie, there are 250 people out there who've paid a lot of money for their tickets. And he just absolutely, at that moment, needed to hear something tangible and practical and kind. And so I turned around and walked back on stage, and there's a famous scene in Doll's House where Nora eats lots of macaroons, and I just lied and said to the audience, I'm so sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I choked on one of the macaroons. Then we carried on the rest of the show and I stayed being an actor. But it was a real wake-up call.
Can I ask you about playing that part in Shameless? Because it was a series that burst onto the screen on Channel 4. You only did two series. Why did you walk out of something that was such a huge... I mean, it continued to be a success after you left, but why did you leave?
Well, I felt that I'd played Fiona, and that can be the difficult thing with long-running series. You know, I just felt that I'd visited as much of her as I... without revisiting. And that's the thing. You're always hungry to do new things and try new things. And so that was it for me, really. I'd sort of lived with her for long enough, I guess.
I wonder, as I listen to you talk about the characters who've been through extreme things that you play so convincingly and well, in this word anguish that comes up so often in reviews and characterisations of your work, what's been the moment in your own life which has been toughest for you to date, off stage?
I've been through a lot, certainly the last few years. It's been all over the papers what I've been through in the last few years, you know, so it's about doing the best that you can. And I'm really interested in several things. One is the fact that we as a species get our faces out of the dirt and try to feel the sun on them. And as a person, I try to do that. I go, okay, this is awful. I feel like I may die. However, I won't. Because there is more of me than I ever imagined there could be. Because I look at what people go through in other scenarios that are much harder than mine. Or what are you going to do? Get your face out the dirt and try to feel the sun on it, you know?
And so tell me then about this next piece of music.
I am a hopeless romantic, you know, I am. And that means, as we just said, sometimes I'll burn with pain as well as burn with desire. I will. Because that's the nature of opening your heart up to someone else. But I refuse to believe that there's a scarcity. I absolutely believe that there is love and more love. Nick Cave's another one of those artists that I have such a crush on. And I chose this because it's a really beautiful, simple love song that is about that tipping point at which you fear you may lose love. And this sounds ironic, of course, but sometimes in a marriage you are never closer than the moment at which the two of you decide it's time to finish. There is such pure intimacy in that moment, and honesty and truth and kindness in all its many versions. So yeah, I suppose I picked this song because it tells me, yeah, I can love and I can hurt, but I can love again.
I hold this letter in my hand, a plea, a petition, a kind of prayer. Hope it does as I have planned. Losing her again is more than I can bear. Kiss the cold white envelope, press my lips against her name. 200 words we live in hope. Sky hangs everywhere.
That was Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and Love Letter. You said, just as you were explaining your reasons for choosing that, Anne-Marie Duff, you talked about it's been all over the papers. And of course, most people will know that for just about a decade you were married to another very well-known actor, James McAvoy. What about that press scrutiny? How do you deal with that kind of scrutiny of things that are private?
There's no escape in as much as you're going through something. You can't leave it at home. You can't go to work and forget about it because everybody at work knows what you're holding hands with. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it was tricky, and also protecting my son from anything like that. Luckily enough, he was young enough for that not to be an issue.
You once said, you know, I'm either sort of having a nervous breakdown on a council estate or I'm in a corset dying. Are you offered enough diversity of parts?
So lucky. Oh, my God. Touching words as I say that. I'm one of the few actors who gets offered such different work. Even just in medium terms, I get to do TV, film and theatre. Not all actors get to do that. One minute I was on Broadway playing Lady M. Literally the project after that, I was in Suffragette playing a working class women's rights activist. And I don't know, karmically, what I did in a previous life, but I'm really grateful
good,
for
whatever,
it. Yeah,
yes.
I was a good girl.
Let's have some more music. We're on your sixth. Tell me about this then, Anne-Marie Duff.
I have an 8-year-old curly haired boy who is so cool. Both James and I just look at each other and we're just bemused. Where did he get his cool from? You could cut him in half and the words rock and roll would literally be written through him. He loves music so much. And so I had to pick something that was one of our songs, and we had a very big discussion about it because he took it really seriously, because he's very serious about his music.
Good.
And he loves this song, and it really makes me think of going to school in the morning, him in the back, and him not knowing that I'm having a sneaky wee in my rear view, him really enjoying listening. And he's in some space. I don't know whether he's playing Glastonbury, but he's in some space. So this is Gorillaz Clint Eastwood, just for him, because he rocks.
Ooh, 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 ooh. I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on. I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
Yeah. Gorillaz and Clint Eastwood. As you look at the landscape within your industry, and I've asked it of other actors that I've spoken to recently and directors, post Harvey Weinstein allegations of non-consensual sex, which he, of course, denies. But for those of us on the outside, it's easy to imagine that there seems to be something really stinking and rotten at the heart of certainly Hollywood.
I suspect that you could lift the rock of a lot of industries and find lots of things crawling underneath. But yeah,
it's so you think it's only interesting is because it's about very glamorous multimillionaires? Is that
I think
why?
It's no. I think it's important that the very glamorous multimillionaires are speaking up. That has a huge ripple effect,
right?
Because if other people see as having everything, have been through things, it makes them maybe feel capable of speaking up themselves. It's very hard to be a whistleblower. It's terrifying, you know, the implications of that.
So as a young actress, just come back to what it was I was thinking about asking you. As a young actress, I presume then you probably were in situations where people said, well, you know, it'd be better if her bum was more like this, or could you just pop your top off, or all that sort of stuff.
Of course, yeah, I won't lie. I have had quite a few experiences in my early career that would curl your toes. This is what's been fascinating, is that we've been talking about them now, myself and my colleagues, my peers, and we hadn't spoken about them before.
Yes.
That's what's been extraordinary, is just this realisation that it wasn't just you. Because quite often you think, oh God, was it me? Was it me? Did I do something? Was I complicit in some way? And also that there's a vast number of people who've had similar experiences. It's just that, isn't it? It's the quantity which has been so extraordinary.
Knowing what you know about your industry, if you had a daughter and she said to you at 13, 14, Mum, you know, I'd love to be an actress. What would you say to her about your industry? Would you trust her to your industry right now?
I think more... Ooh, it's hard to know, isn't it? I think I would have the conversation with my child and say, you are your most precious thing and you have to take care of yourself and know that the only people who get to share your preciousness are the people you choose. You have a right to say no If something makes you feel uncomfortable in any situation in your life, you say no, because nothing is worth the betrayal of a yes.
But it's interesting that you had to think hard there about that. I mean, given how much you've gotten still, on the balance, on the weight, you had to think, if I had a daughter, what would I say to her?
This is an important conversation that we're having at the moment, isn't it? I can't be flippant about it, you know, in that way.
Let's take a break, Anne-Marie Duff. We're going to have some more of your music, and we're on your seventh.
I picked this beautiful song, Alison, by Elvis Costello, because a few years ago, I sadly lost one of my very close friends, Ali. And we had joked once about having songs with our names in them, and she said, I will always outcool you all because I have Alison by Elvis Costello. And she died very suddenly, and it was a real shock to all of us who loved her. Love her. And she sewed me into my wedding dress. And my little boy wasn't very well when he was first born, and she was the person who was on the phone 3-4 times a day. And we got digs together, you know, when we were on tour. Ali was the wardrobe supervisor. And we just laughed all the time. She just was extraordinary. And I find, as time goes by, I think about her more and more. Grief is an interesting thing, you know, because it comes visiting when it wants. It's servant to no man, you know, and it's absolutely forces you to confront its presence. I am here, you will deal with me now. And I find that the gentle grieving of her is something that I just carry with me.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. And with the way you look, I understand that you were not impressed. But I heard you let that little friend of mine your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other stick of Valentine's.
That was Elvis Costello and Alison. I've looked through lots of reviews, Anne-Marie Duff.
Oh, I never do.
Do you never?
No way, Jose.
Your reviews, I should make that clear.
Lots of your own.
Yes, yeah, very few of those. You know, sometimes, of course, reviewers don't like the production. They never don't like you, though. Do you know when you're in a production that's not going down well? Do you?
Sometimes you do, and sometimes you think, oh, I thought this was quite good, this show. Even though I don't read them, you get a sense of the way other people are.
Sure.
The way they carry themselves. If they think, oh, your confidence has dipped. Oh, maybe we've had some bad reviews, or you've had a bad review. Because I don't read them, because I always say they're like reading somebody else's diary. You won't stop until you find something bad about yourself.
When you go to the theatre, are you able, or do you go to the theatre?
Yes.
Are you able to go and abandon yourself and just watch it as a viewer, or are you kind of always just thinking, oh, they did that?
No, mostly I can look. There's this brilliant quote Michael Gambon once said in an interview, which really made me laugh. You don't see pilots going to the airport to watch each other take off. Which I love. But I'm the absolute opposite. I love going to the theatre. I love to be inspired by other people, and when something's great, it's just, oh, there's nothing like it, you know. And
you have great feats of imagination, obviously, Anne-Marie Duff. Have you imagined yourself on this island? Have you thought about what it would be like to wake up and be there alone?
I'd be miserable.
Would you?
Yeah. I like a bit of solitude, but I really do need company and conversation. And it's interesting, all of the pieces of music I chose have been songs, which surprised me, but I need words in my life. I talk to myself all the time if I was alone. I mean, I do, walking around the supermarket, but if I was on an island, I just would. I talk to myself all the time, because if you take away all that we have, our clothes, our money, every single thing that we own, all we have are our words. Those are the gifts we give each other, you know, and I don't know where I'd be without a good old chat with someone.
Tell me about your eighth disc.
I I'm Irish, and I'm very proud of my heritage. My mother's from Donegal and my dad is from Meath, but they met in Shepherd's Bush in the 60s. A lot of Irish people did. And my heritage has afforded me so many gifts. And it's meant that I've got to spend a lot of time in Ireland, which I love. And that's something I share with my son. One of the things I adore about that culture, and it could be said about Scottish culture too, but is the notion of standing up in a group of people and singing. And there is something so fantastic about hearing an unaccompanied voice sing a song And generally it'll be a story song. And it has, the effect of alarming all my nerve endings, you know, and I find it really exciting. And I guess it's theatre. That's the point, is theatre, isn't it? So I love this singer, Declan O'Rourke. He's an Irish singer. And this is his own composition, but it sounds like a traditional ballad. It's about this woman who's been widowed by the sea. You know, she's lost husbands and a young man courting her and asking her to be his wife. And she says, I can't. So it's just sort of linked to all of those things for me.
Well, I stood before the ocean in the middle of the night. 'Cause I loved her so, I asked her then if she would be my wife. And then I closed my eyes and waited, and I listened for an answer.
That was Declan O'Rourke singing Marrying the Sea. Anne-Marie, it's time, of course, for me to give you some books. You get the Bible, you get the complete works of Shakespeare, you get to take one other book along.
This has been really hard because I'm a bookworm. I got it down to three. So I got Maya Angelou, Phenomenal Woman. Also, Collected Poems, Emily Dickinson. And then finally, it was Mill on the Floss, George Eliot. As much as I love poetry, I'm going to go with The Mill on the Floss.
Okay.
And it's so pertinent. You know, it's about a young woman craving education and the opportunity to love as she pleases. But also, it's just so beautifully written. And I worked on a stage adaptation of it when I was 25. And it was a glorious time for me. But mostly just because it's the most extraordinary novel.
It's yours.
A
little luxury, or indeed a big one.
Okay, now, again, I have two choices, being a typical Libra, and I find it very hard to decide some things. So I'm learning to play the flute, so I thought, would I take my flute and give me something to do? But if I'm being really honest, my absolute luxury would be... I'm slightly embarrassed to say it, but would be beautiful underwear. As an actor, most of the time you have to dress like an unmade bed because you're going to rehearsals and God knows what you'll be doing. But underneath all of that, I always have lovely underwear. And I thought, do you know what? If I was stuck on a desert island, how glorious would it be? And nobody would be around to see it. I could run around in the most divine bra and pants and feel like $1 million. And if it is a luxury, if we're going to say it has to be a luxury, then that's a proper luxury.
It certainly is, and it is yours. Which of these discs would you save?
Very difficult. I am going to go with In It Cave and the Bad Seeds. I'm going to go with Love Letter, because at the end of everything, love is the answer. So I'm going to go with a love song.
It's yours, Anne-Marie Duff. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much for asking me.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs with Anne-Marie Duff. You'll find more interviews with actors like Dame Judi Dench and Hugh Bonneville, sports stars, scientists, musicians and artists at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs.
This is the BBC.
Hello there, we hope you enjoyed that podcast, but as Lieutenant Columbo so presciently put it, there's just one more thing.
Why not consider listening to The Now Show as part of the Friday night comedy from the BBC?
No, I'm sure Columbo never said that.
Then he was missing out, wasn't he? It's the topical comedy show hosted by us, Puns and Dennis.
All you have to do is find us wherever you get your podcasts and make sure you subscribe.